I'm Laura Vinroot Poole. For 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store. Capital has never really been about fashion. It's always been about people. What we wore was created to share the meaningful journeys that inspire me. From the designers and friends I meet on the road to the men and women with whom I work each day.
Everybody wants to know her name.
David D. Benedetto is a dear friend and the creative force behind Garden and Gun. We sat down in his Charleston office, shared a bourbon, and chatted about his craft and our love for the South. This is the first episode in our five-episode capsule in partnership with Garden and Gun. Dave D. Benedetto. It's a tongue twister.
Yes.
But how'd
yes,
I do?
It is. You did well. You did perfect.
Thank you. I went to school with a Benedetto, but not a D. Benedetto.
Got it. Benedetto means blessed one.
Of course
and,
it does.
And D would be of the blessed ones.
Ones.
Yeah. I'm trying to fulfill that. But we'll see.
You are a Southerner. You're from Savannah, Georgia. A lot of our listeners are not from the South. Can you tell people what Savannah's like? And
Savannah has a great historic district, and it's centered around, and I hope I remember my history, 12 or 14 squares that were originally laid out by James Oglethorpe in 1733. See, they did do well in
Georgia
nativity
history.
School. But I didn't grow up downtown. I grew up on Wilmington Island, which was, you know, just outside, probably 20 minutes from downtown, and in the most idyllic setting imaginable. You know, we lived on the Wilmington River.
Yeah.
So I was a creek kid.
Yeah.
You know, a dock rat, river rat, and that was my passion.
Yeah.
You know, from the time I could explore the marsh to the time I could get in a John boat to the time I could take the family's bigger boat out, that's what I did.
And you're one of three boys.
I'm actually the youngest of four.
Youngest of four.
Yeah. So
wow.
I had those brothers to teach me. Fortunate enough that I had access to boats.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just a tremendous thing to have.
And are y'all all totally into them still?
Three of the four of us.
Okay.
And the second oldest, Christian, he's a mathematics genius.
Uh-huh.
You know, the kind of kid that gets missed one question on the math SATs, right? I can't add.
A lot like me. Yeah.
I literally cannot add. Anyway, he was always into, you know, remote control airplanes and sailboats and this and that, but appreciated it all, you know. But the three of us still really need it in our lives,
yeah.
Which is so special for me to be able to live in Charleston now.
Yeah, and do the others live in
boating
places?
Yeah, well, at least close enough where they can get to it and get their fix. I mean, it really is. I mean, you know, when I lived in New York City, I had access to Long Island Sound and Montauk. But in, say, December, February, and March, a sad person. Anyway, I need it.
Yeah.
And it really has kind of shaped who I am. You know, back then when I wanted to write, and I was one of those weird kids that I just started writing in sixth grade.
Yeah.
I remember that I was sitting down watching TV with my family, and there was a show on, and somebody on that show was a writer, and I thought, I have a story to tell. And I went upstairs and grabbed a piece of paper and just started writing. And I always wanted to be a writer. And back then, my writing was what I was passionate about, you know, about the river and a boy
yeah.
who was, you know, I tried to write fiction, who loved dolphins and was out on the boat. And it was a ripoff of Flipper. But anyway, it's been nice that I had that.
You went to UVM.
Yes.
To a school in Vermont. What was that transition like? How did that feel to go from Savannah to Burlington, Vermont?
Yeah.
And had you ever seen snow before?
Yeah. Okay. So I'd only seen snow when my family would go on. Maybe three times in my life when I was growing up, we went out west and we ski, you know, family ski vacation.
Yeah.
And I thought I was pretty good skier. And I got to Vermont, and I remember you could get on this bus for like $25 at 7 in the morning on a weekend, and they take you up to the mountain, and then they take you home when the mountain's closed. And so a few of us went, and I'll be honest, like four beautiful gals and me. And I was like, sure, I can ski. Yeah, let's go. You know, I'm feeling good. First run we go, they're like, are you cool with, like, you know, starting with a black diamond? And I'm like, oh, man. Yeah, I'm good with that. And it was a bumpy black diamond.
Icy.
And they shot down like the most wonderful, talented skiers that they were. and I crashed like every three bumps. And by the time I got down, you know, their skis were off. They were waiting for me. And I said, just go. I'll meet you at the bus at 5 p.m.
And you like sat up and cried.
Yeah. It was a good learning lesson for my humility.
What did you wear? Like, how did you prepare to go to Vermont?
I was born and raised in Savannah, Georgia. My parents, both originally from Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
So
they knew
so
about
the
sweaters.
North wasn't so foreign to me. You know, we visited the city. We went to see my grandparents, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But still as a visitor. And, you know, all I knew is I was going to be wearing a lot of jeans and flannel shirts.
Sure.
Which, you know, just layer upon layer. And there was one morning going to class where it was 18 degrees, 18 below with the wind chill. And I have this big, you know, puffy coat on and all my flannel and this, you know, a beanie cap, which at one point I just pulled down over, just over my, I was so cold, you know, just over my eyes, and then eventually turned around and went back to the dorm. But it was beautiful. And I went there because while I love the South and everything about it, I thought, okay, I'll be home for the summer. Let's go explore somewhere new. And Vermont, it's the most, you know,
beautiful.
I love the outdoor world.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's it. You know, I became a better skier.
Yeah.
Fished in the spring. I mean, you know, hiked in the fall. It was kind of great.
I think we've talked about this before, that John Shelton Reed,
yes,
who's the writer,
right,
from,
yeah,
Chapel Hill,
of course,
always says,
yeah,
he says the people that really know the South are able to identify the South, I guess, the South, are people that have left.
Right.
You know, that,
right,
it's hard to see where you are unless you've been away.
Absolutely. And,
yeah,
and to appreciate it.
Yeah.
To truly, I mean, I knew I loved it, but to truly appreciate it. I mean, I remember I used to drive an old Bronco too, you know, and I'd drive up in the spring and then come back or I'd drive up in the fall, excuse me, and come back in the spring. And I remember that drive home in the spring, and you know, as you get, this would be May, as you get farther down I-95, just watching the trees, you know,
yeah,
get a little greener and green, you know,
yeah,
and to the point where you realized you were home.
Yeah.
And where landscape became so important to me understanding that.
Tell me about William Gherkin.
Oh, wow. So I might cry. So, you know, my mentor, really, my Southern mentor, he was my next door neighbor, retired assistant high school principal, and also taught shop at the high school.
Not your high school?
Not my high school.
Right.
No, public school in Savannah. You know, somehow, as a five-year-old, I found something in him. I realized that he was a person I wanted to be around.
Yeah.
So I would literally go over to his door and ring the bell. I'd stand, you know, reach for the bell, and his wife would come out, and I would say, Mr. Gherkin's mommy. Is it okay if Mr. Gherkin comes out to play? He would come out and we would talk. And over the years, I learned so much from him. He understood the river that we lived on like no one else,
yeah,
I knew or had access to, and taught me about what a full moon means to the shrimp coming out of the marsh,
yeah,
and what a half moon means to the trout, or that when the dogwoods are blooming, that meant in the spring, that meant the whiting were coming in. I gained a respect and an appreciation for that understanding.
Yeah.
So I love to fish. And what I love about fishing is that when I catch a fish, it's not that reeling in a fish is so fun, or, you know, I get to hold it up for a picture, but that for that very moment, I've connected with a wild creature, and I've understood
why
where they
did.
Were.
Yeah.
You know, like I've understood, I thought, okay, they're going to be on this point because the wind's blowing this way and the tide's going that way. And if they are, that confirms that I understand this natural world a little bit.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but, and that's what I get such a kick out of.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's to me means more than anything.
You had another mentor in your life, John Mather.
So went to Vermont, came out of school, got a job at Men's Journal in New York City.
And what was that like?
I mean tremendous. It was my dream, right?
But sartorially, I mean to go from Savannah to Vermont,
yeah,
and then to New York. Like, how did you handle this?
It was a nightmare. I thought everybody was still wearing their khakis and their button-down shirt. And, you know, this was the same office as Rolling Stone and Us Weekly. So,
yeah,
you know, I had no idea. I walk in and I'm like, wow, I don't look like the rest of everyone here in my fashion choices. So John Mather had been the fashion director for Esquire for years.
Yeah.
And he had come to Men's Journal and he was doing nice work there. And he just took me under his wing, you know, at one point said, why don't we go shopping? I'm like, okay.
And where'd you go?
So we were on 52nd and 6th Avenue. Mm-hmm. And Brooks Brothers. Is that simple? Brooks Brothers.
The original.
Was a block, right, a block away.
Yeah.
And we walked down there, and, you know, we walked in, and they knew him. I had no idea, but even the folks on the floor knew him. And he just kind of did this. You know, meanwhile, I'm trailing behind going, I am never going to wear that. Like, are you crazy? So let's say I tried on six things, we chose five. Three of them I felt out of my comfort zone, but I wore them. And you know, for the first time in New York City, certainly, people say, hey, you look nice. Yeah. I like your shirt. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm on to something here. Yeah. Can we go shopping again? So we would go... at least twice a year, sometimes three, and just do the, just
thing.
To load up on, you know, yeah.
But I also do think, especially that original Brooks Brothers is a real Southern pilgrimage.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, he knew me, right? I'm not one to go totally out of my comfort zone, but he certainly was dragging me out of my Savannah, Georgia, UVM, you know, look. And it was nice because when I started to dress that way, I started to feel like, okay, you know, this is how I should dress. I want to succeed in this in New York City, and I want to move up, and I want people, if I'm called into their office, you know, I don't want to look like I just came out of, you know, English 401 or whatever. And I it was great.
And you were writing at Men's Journal, and then...
Yeah. So I, believe it or not, I wrote the fashion copy. That's how I got to know John very well. And, you know, Men's Journal was trying to do this thing where they made fashion real, and they wanted to, you know, we tried to choose models who were into sports and things that might reflect some of the clothes we were choosing. So it was my job to call up these models and interview them and find out some nugget or story that, you know, it's still short, like 200 words.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my
gig. I love that.
So yeah, I wrote all at the same time folding in the clothes, you know, the John Varvatos jacket and the RLX.
And did you learn a ton about clothes?
Oh, I mean, of course.
Yeah.
And that's where I really, you know, learned it from John, because I was so close to that process.
Yeah.
And the fashion photographers and just also, you know, I remember the high, back then it was the high, high and the low.
Yeah.
You know, the high and the low. And you'd have your RLX jacket on top and your fancy pants on, you know, and I learned a lot.
And then from there, I went to Field & Stream.
I left Men's Journal to write a book, a nonfiction book. I followed the migration of the striped bass from Maine to North Carolina in the fall of 2001. So it's a book that uses fishing as a vehicle, but it's really about the natural history and the people and the road trip. And I mean, it was the greatest boondoggle I ever created. So for, you know, 4 months I was on the road and fished
with people along the way. Or?
Yeah. So met guides, met people, you know, again, out of my comfort zone, going up to introduce myself, meeting people, you know, calling ahead. And, but also it happened during 9/11.
Wow.
And that really became a powerful part of that book. But to just see how it played out across, not only right then and there, I was in Maine when it happened, but just the rest of the book. I mean, I'm fishing in New York Harbor a month later, you could still smell the World Trade Center, the burning smell that I always say, you know, I don't know if you were there or not, but it's like an electric, burnt electric smell. And it was just still there.
Yeah.
A month later, because it was still smoldering.
That's extraordinary. You
know? Anyway, sorry, long answer, but yes. And then the Field & Stream.
And Field & Stream writing.
Yeah, writing and it mostly editing. And that's where I met. Well, I'd met my good friend, Sid Evans, who's now the editor of Southern Living, right as we kind of passed each other at Men's Journal. And I worked with him.
Is Sid from Alabama?
He's from Memphis.
Memphis. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And so that was my Southern connection.
Yeah.
There was. Yeah. It was I met that Southern friend who had not only the same passions, but also the same, you know, interest in, you know, your work.
Yeah, and this is how you navigate,
yeah,
like, the things you love and being Southern in New York.
Right, and it was really refreshing to see, you know, it's like, wow, you're just like me.
And then he moved to Garden of Gun, and then he recruited you.
Yeah, so,
things in between.
Right, we were working together, and he came in and said, have you heard about this magazine, Garden of Gun? And like everyone else, I laughed at the name. And I said, you know, sorta. And he had a copy and he said, you know, they've reached out to me. I'm curious what you think. You know, so I spent some time with it. And then I went back to him and said, I think this has so much potential.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, and it's in Charleston. So he debated this for a number of weeks, and then came in one day and said, you know, I'm going to do it. And I said, well, if you need a number two, I mean, half joking, but not.
Yeah.
I said, if you need a number two, I'll come.
Yeah.
And he's like, really? And I said, yeah. He goes, let's do it.
Wow.
And so, you know, there were little formalities after that, but that's how it happened. And I mean, who knew? I you know, like the idea that you would be in the South producing a magazine that you were proud of, that you loved, that represented what you loved about the South. If you had told me 2 weeks before all that happened, I would have said you were crazy.
Yeah, you couldn't have.
No, I couldn't have ever imagined it. But I was so well prepared because of that stint I had done in the city with the, you know, the best of the best in magazine making, you know?
Yeah, and knowing what the best meant, I guess, or, you know, how you wanted to run it, how you...
Yeah. I mean, I was so fortunate. I didn't go to journalism school. I was an English major, but I always knew I wanted to be in magazines. I had the best journalism school in those 7 years at Mentor.
Yeah.
And that just teed it up to come down here, you know, a few years later. So I was fortunate.
Soon after you came, the recession hit.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah, we have this meeting. We were in the old office, which is much smaller than the current office. And Rebecca, our CEO, calls us together. And, you know, there were maybe 12 of us at the time. I think now there are 50 of us in the whole office. And she started crying. And we were like, oh, God, this is not going to be good.
I can't remember if I knew it in the moment while it was happening. Like, did you know that it was happening?
There, you know, you get these pulses in the media business because the advertisers are pulling back when they think it might be coming, and they're pretty good at knowing what's coming, right? So there was some fear, but it wasn't, you know, we were a year into it, and you know, the message was the Post and Courier, the you know, the newspaper in town who owned the magazine, who founded it, was, you know, cutting us loose. In other words, shutting us down.
Right.
But to Rebecca's credit, you know, and I don't know that we all believed her at that point, she's like, we're going to keep this going. I want to keep this going. It's too good. Our readers love it. Mm-hmm. We will find a way. We all pitched in, you know, we all had salary cuts and, you know, the printer didn't work. I mean, we were printing a magazine and we didn't have a printer. You know, we'd go to Kinko's and print out the layouts and then someone would bring them back. And, you know, we all believed in it.
Yeah.
You know, if it was New York City, we would have scattered.
Right.
But we were here, we were this tight-knit group, and we had something that we believed in, and a lot of other people, mainly readers, believed in. And, you know, we're like, let's just keep going, you know, let's just keep trying. And
And what do you think made it pull through?
Well, thankfully, Rebecca found an investor.
Right. Well,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that really did, right?
Yeah.
So that allowed us to keep the lights on long enough to survive that recession.
Yeah.
And as soon as advertisers, you know, felt good about spending money again, off we went. And it made us better. It made us stronger. It made us better. It made us understand how well you can do with so little.
And it probably made you understand what made you special.
There was somebody wrote a reader wrote a letter to Rebecca and said, if you shut this magazine down, I'm going to come hunt you down. You know? But it was this sense of like, you know, Pete, this is special. Like, you know, it's too... I don't know. I've worked at a lot of really cool magazines. I've been very fortunate. And the enthusiasm of the reader.
It's so different here.
It's so different.
Yeah.
It is so different. You know, I used to work, you know, I worked at Man's Journal, which is a great national magazine, and Field and Stream, the biggest outdoor magazine ever. This was the first magazine where my parents were like, wow, we're hearing so much about your magazine. You know, like they were proud all of a sudden. I'm like, well, you know, I didn't do nothing for the last. Anyway, the readers are... I mean, they really make this a special place to work.
Well, I think, and the readers also, they treat them like books. I mean,
they
save them.
Right. And, you know, and I think that's part of this magazine's secret to its success is that it's only six times a year and we think of it as a publishing event, you know, not something that we expect you to throw away as soon as you're done with it or before you even read it. Right. And so everything is poured into that cover and every page, you know, you just want to make every page special. I tell these guys until they're blue in the face and they don't need to hear it. Just imagine that this is there's a new reader opening it up to the whatever random page it may be. Like, that's our chance.
Yeah.
Right. Like, that's our chance to show them and hook them and keep them. So make sure the caption's perfect and the headline is perfect and the lead of the story.
You and, love and every part of this. You love the writing, but you also love the layouts and the...
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something I've learned. I've come to really appreciate more.
Yeah.
To truly understand from a visual perspective. I love covers.
And do you think that the visual part comes from your men's journal?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But also, when you're making those decisions and when you're presented with three different layouts and it's like on you, okay, you know, what do you like here? And then, but then also listening to the people who did it, you know, like our creative director, Marshall McKinney, you know, hearing his rationale for the three different layouts and what each of them does differently. It's really special.
Yeah.
And also a tremendous learning experience and then taking that with you. But I love covers. I just think that a cover should set the tone for your magazine in every issue. I want it to sit on your coffee table. I think of the Perfect Garden and Gun cover where it's like art and commerce.
Yeah.
And that's when it really sings.
And distribution is, it's all over the country and the
world. Yeah, right.
And is it just Southern diaspora or is it?
You know, that's a good question.
Yeah.
We don't know totally. I mean, we know a lot of it is well, let's just say this. 42% of our circulation is outside of the, you know, beyond the Mason-Dixon line.
Right.
California is, I think, the 10th largest and New York is the 9th.
Wow.
And that is a lot of expats who are missing the South and also folks who just like this lifestyle,
yeah,
you know, and who appreciate
outdoors. Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah.
Or
food, outdoors, shelter, interesting people and good storytelling. So many folks say, you know, I never thought I would, this magazine would mean anything to me. I don't care about fly fishing, but I read the story about a fly fisherman and I couldn't stop.
Yeah. Well, you've done a beautiful job.
Thanks.
Tell me what you think a stylish Southern man is.
Someone who looks like he's not trying hard.
Yes.
You know, like I can't stand the dandy. And maybe that's me because I don't feel comfortable peacocking around or something. You know, I like the jacket, the wax cotton jacket that looks like you actually wore it
right
outside at some point. And maybe it does have a little mud from the duck blind on it or not.
Are there any Southerners that you find stylish?
That is a good question, honestly. I mean, what's your answer?
Tom Wolfe, just because he dressed for the occasions. And
right.
I think that that's one thing that that Southerners do so well. And I think that we have nice manners and that
right.
we show up. And it's respectful to the host.
That's absolutely right. You know, I appreciate someone who does that. And our style director, Haskell Harris, is amazing at this. It seems effortless.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems like, oh, I just threw this on and out I went. And, you know, and it's stunning and beautiful and it stops you in your tracks. But there's not this, you know, sense. It comes with an ease.
You've done a lot in your career. You've won many awards. You've been very successful. But what does success mean for you?
You know, that's a good question. I think I would have given you a different answer 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would have. I know.
Before children?
Before children, before maybe having some of that success, you know, and understanding what really fulfills you.
Mm.
Now, success for me is connected with doing well and doing good. And I think about this magazine and I hope that we are portraying an inclusive South, you know, a progressive South, and showing folks, I mean, look, I know there are some awful parts of the South, but it's really nice to work at a place where we can shine a light on the great parts of this place and the work being done to understand our past and to make things better. For me, that's coupled. Of course, everybody loves the awards, and I do too, because I'm as competitive as they get. I really am. But it's meant something to have those awards, but also know at night that you're doing something good.
Yeah.
You know, that it makes a difference. I mean, really, how many people get to say that?
Not many.
You know, like that is so special. And you know, of course, I said I worry a lot. And sometimes I worry like, oh my gosh, it's so good. I can't stop. But that's sort of my idea of success. And again, kids, you know, coming home at night and, you know, Jenny and I, I'm getting deep, worked really hard to have children.
Yeah.
Really, really hard. Years, infertility doctors, everything. And we were successful eventually. And it was terrific. And I think we both appreciate those children so much more for knowing how close we were to not having them.
Yeah.
So coming home at night and hearing, you know, laughing and smiling and or crying and screaming, you know, like that is part of it. It just feels good and successful.
Yeah.
You know, we're just happy and content. You know, I think I would have said 10 years ago, it would have been much more about work.
Yeah.
And now life has kind of folded in a way that I appreciate all of it, not just a great fishing day. Mm-hmm. You know, I appreciate a wonderful breakfast at the table where Sam's telling a joke and Rosie's throwing eggs across the, you know, the room. And the dog's, you know, jumping up and licking the milk. But, you know, that's really, you know, that's what we remember.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm going to think about 40 years from now, 50 years from now. It's not, you know,
awards dinner.
Award.
Right. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I can't wait to hear your answer. What did you wear to the prom?
Yeah, I mean, a cheap rented tux.
From where? Fines? Did Fines have a men's?
No, they didn't. This was like a local shop in Savannah where, you know, I went with my mom and, you know,
was there a nice men's store in Savannah?
Jay Rook.
Haberdashery?
Jay Rook.
Is it still there?
Yeah, still is. It's a family store. My mother and father, my mother raised four boys. My dad was a doctor.
Yeah.
Style was not something they were concerned about.
Right.
I learned that when I was probably eight. No, I was probably like 9 or 10, and my next door neighbor was having a birthday party. He was a couple of years younger than me, and I put on my favorite Madras shorts and my striped polo, and I went over there. My mom saw me.
And they probably weren't yours. They probably were. They were hand-me-downs,
sure,
right?
They were, right. And yeah. My mom saw me, and she didn't stop me. And I got over there like half an hour before the party started, and my friend's mom was like, "Whoa, Dave, nice outfit," you know. And I had no idea.
Yeah.
Like I was like, "What's wrong with this?" You know. And then she sort of explained it to me, and I ran home and changed.
You've been in the creek all day. You were just kind of like,
"Yeah, you know,
are."
But the point being is, mom didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, she cared that I was there for dinner.
Yeah.
My prom. Okay, so the most memorable prom is I was I loved playing football, and I had broken my hand in spring practice. So I had this giant cast. I've broken my middle finger and hand, and I had this awful clunky cast on. And we went there to get suited, you know, fitted for my tux, which had to allow for the cast.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So in all my prom pictures, I'm like, you know, this big cast hand over my date.
Thank you, Dave.
Sure.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda.
What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.